It's a pleasure to introduce Professor James Diamond, who's the Joseph and Wolf Lubavitch Chair of Jewish Study at the University of Waterloo. He is has a PhD in religious studies in medieval Jewish history. He's written a number of books. His next upcoming book is being published by Oxford University Press. He's an expert on the Rambam, an expert in many aspects of medieval Jewish history, a former lawyer, and a local Torontonian, and it's a pleasure to welcome here this morning. Bakasha.
Thanks, Jay. Everybody has a source sheet? Yeah, I got one, yeah. Okay, so I have a number of sources there. I'm not sure I'm going to get through all of them, but whatever we get through, we get through. I'm going to try and convey my main point, and that I'm sure I'll get through, but there'll be some other things that I think will have to be left for part two. Part two of love. So if you look at the first source I have, number one, it's simply a kind of word search of the times that the root for love, ahav, the word ahav, which can mean other things besides what we identify with love, appears 248 times. All of you could do that with a word search. 47 of them expressing human love, and as you would expect, a lot of them occurring in Shir HaShirim, in the Song of Songs, which of course is the quintessential book about love between human beings. It covers all kinds of relationships, parental love, fraternal love, friendship between men, conjugal relationships. So it covers a range of relationships where that occurs, and it also appears as commandments, right? So we have a actual command. There's three commandments that are based on love, that command you to love, and that is the love of God, and we'll talk about that a bit, which is articulated in a much different way than other loves. And then there is the love of the foreigner, the ger. Of course, the ger in biblical times does not mean a convert. We tend to have kind of anachronized that, but the ger clearly in biblical times means the foreigner, the alien resident who lives among you. That's the ger. You're commanded to love the ger. And the famous one, v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love. I wouldn't say your fellow man. I'll talk about that in a few moments. I mean, it's become idealized and has become really the crux. I mean, even Rabbi Akiva made it the basic principle of Judaism. It's certainly become the crux, of Christianity. Love thy neighbor as yourself. Although I'm going to pour a little bit of rain on that parade when we're talking about the biblical sense of it. So I wanted to talk about the connection between the loves that we see in all the narratives in the Bible and the loves that are commanded. So what struck me, and probably maybe strikes a lot of you, is that virtually, I always say virtually because I cover myself, because maybe there's always somebody in the audience who's more an expert than me, will find one that defies what I'm about to say. But virtually all of them, all stories, all narratives in the Bible that revolve around love, in this sense, ahav, are disastrous, catastrophic in some senses, fragmenting. So if we look at some of them, which I can just list a few. If we have, for instance, Rebecca and Jacob, right? So, Rebecca and Isaac. So Rebecca, Isaac loves Rebecca. We have that. Actually, that's the first time we have in the Bible not the first time we have love, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but the first time you have an erotic love, let's say, but it's not necessarily erotic, a conjugal love, a love between a man and a woman. That's the first time when Isaac loves Rebecca. The problem there is, and I'll mention in a moment, is that he doesn't love Rebecca probably for who she is, but he takes her into his tent, and he's comforted after his mother. So the love is kind of displaced there, and it's not really, I would say, the kind of love that we identify with romantic love. It's clearly not. But then that leads to a total fragmentation of the family. Because then we have that love proceeding to the next generation, we have Isaac loving Esau, right? That's what the Torah says. And then we have Rebecca loving Yaakov, right? Now, the minute you read those words, you know that this story is not headed in a good direction, right? And this probably a lot of us can identify with. I mean, it's a fact. We all like to say we love our children equally. You know, it's a platitude. But, you know, it's not true. I mean, I think the Bible actually is much more true to life than we tend to make it. We tend to idealize a lot of the relationships, but it's simply not true. I mean, when we read the Bible without its rabbinic overlay, we might get to a few of those things. It clearly reflects life the way it is. And there are, there are divisions in families. There are children you love more than other children. There are children that the mother loves, and there are children that the father loves. But the minute you read that, you see that the family is fragmented. It's not heading in a good direction, and it doesn't. And it doesn't, right? It leads to deception. The mother deceives the husband. The wife deceives the husband. The son deceives the father. There is hatred, in fact, hatred to the point where, not unusual for the Bible, where a brother wants to kill another brother. We've actually had the precedent where a brother actually kills a brother, one of the first events in history. And so those loves lead nowhere. If I take Samson, for instance, Samson is a very interesting story. And I'm skipping over a lot because I don't really have that much time. But the rest of them all, trust me, just are terrible, right? Disastrous. So with Samson, but it's a very clear story. Because in many ways, there's lots of themes that run through the Samson story. But one of the themes are women, right? His relationships with women. So really, there are four women. Many people boil it down to three, but really, there are four. So you can start with the mother. That is, most people leave that one out. But she's a very prominent character in the Samson story. There is the Jewish mother, who perhaps is the ideal. But Samson goes through a number of relationships. And if you chart them, his life can be charted along a trajectory of those relationships. So first, he is caught up in a romance. I don't even know if it's a romance, because it's not described as that. That's what's important. That is, he is enticed by a foreign woman. literally, it's as if an Israeli Jew would go into Gaza. I mean, that's where it was, and marry a Palestinian. That's exactly what happened. And you can imagine how this went over with his parents. And so he marries. So you have marriage. The first woman is marriage. The second woman is a prostitute. He spends a night with a prostitute. So you have marriage. For one reason or another, he marries her. He obviously likes her. He is enticed by maybe a foreign culture. The next one is a prostitute, also a common thing, of course, the oldest profession. But the third one, Delilah, is the only one that it starts off with that he loved her. So you have different relationships. The wife is clearly not based on that. The prostitute is clearly not based on that. And the third relationship is Delilah. And we all know, I think you all kind of know the Samson story. We all know where that went in terms of that relationship. That was the relationship that brought him down, right? In fact, I think it actually highlights the main point that I want to talk about of why that is. And so I'm going to leave that for a moment and go back to what I found when I started to think about these stories. It really took me in a direction that I didn't want to go. But after all, I'm talking about biblical love, and I don't want to sugarcoat things. I don't want to say, you know, it portrays love as a beautiful thing, right? Peace and love, you know, this is what it's all about. I don't think so. I think the Bible, if you take all the stories together, there seems to be a point. If all narratives end in disaster, in fragmentation, in hatred, then it seems to be making a point, right? The stories make a point that maybe love between human beings is not such a good thing, not such a good thing. And therefore, there is only one love. Well, there's three loves, but I'll talk about that in a moment. There is only one love that has its place, a love, an all-consuming love, which is a love for God. Now let me go. So I knew a lot of people would not like this, but even, you know, Haredim, you know, the Orthodox community might love this, but they won't when I talk about it a little more. So nobody really likes this, but this is where it took me. So if you go back to the Garden of Eden, and this is go back to my source sheet. Do I have your source sheet that I? Anyways. If you go back to the Garden of Eden, so I have source 2 and 3. So there's two stories, two narratives, right? Biblical scholars look at them as two contradictory narratives or two stories that come from different sources. I look at them together. So in both those stories, where it talks about the creation of woman, right? In the first story, you have the creation of woman, that's source 2, woman and man together. If one would read it literally, a bi-gendered being that are, and Chazal actually understand it this way, many Chazals understand it this way, that this was one bi-gendered human being, very nice for discussions that go on today about which washroom would they use, right? So there would be neutral washrooms in the Garden of Eden, at least in this story. In the second story, you have a very different account that, according to tradition, right, is not contradictory to the first account, but fills in the details of how woman was created. But in the second story, you have a clear separation, I'm not going to go through it. Rib actually could be the side, could be split in half. Tzela actually might not mean rib. But whatever the story is, you know the deal. Lo tov eyot adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. He needs somebody ezer kenegdo, right? He needs somebody opposite him. That is, it's not good to be one being that collapses both the male and the female into one. And here's I think I'm getting to my main point about why the Bible doesn't like love. But what I thought was curious, when we get in the second account, and this is source 3, it tells us what's going to happen. Here's the history of the world, the history of relationships between men and women. Al-Kain, right, Yazov ish et aviv et imo. Therefore, because of what's happened, because of this whole story, or as a result, following this story, the way of the world will be men will leave their parents' household, v'davak b'ishto v'hayu lebasar echad, and he will cleave to his wife and become one flesh. Now, very nice. Probably what it means, becoming one flesh, they can't literally become one flesh. In a sense, they're going back to the original ideal, right, where they were created as a bi-gendered being. But they can no longer be that. But a man and a woman can come as close as they can to that ideal, which is in the sexual act, right? That two beings come as close as you can to becoming one body. Obviously, they can't become one body. So they retrieve some aspect of that first account. But what I thought was curious was, where's love? Where's love, right? It's a very kind of functional kind of thing. In fact, somebody like Rashi, who is, of course, you know, the be-all and end-all of traditional interpretations. What does it mean to be basar echad? It means they come together, human beings come together in the child, right? But notice that what Rushi is saying is that he doesn't see love as playing a role. The relationship between men and women are purely functional, and that relationship results in a fulfillment of a primary commandment, which is to have a child. So Rushi reads it that way. By the way, Nachmanides, Ramban, who usually, to my mind, the Ramban's main opponent, the one he takes on time after time after time, anybody who's read the entire Perush understands most of the time people say Rambam, Maimonides, is his main opponent. That's true to some extent, but nowhere near Rashi. I actually think he pretty well, I'll use a very strong word, hates Rashi. He has to deal with him because by his time, Rashi had already accumulated somewhat of a reputation. We're not talking that far off, but it's already a century and a half, something like that, a couple of centuries. But if you read his parish, Einena Nachon, this is not correct, Ein Tam V'Reach, and worse. So the Ramban usually has very, very good questions, and on this score he asks a very good question. He says, Rashi, I don't understand Rashi, because this seems to distinguish human beings from animals, that this is a quality that human beings have, that they can come together as basar echad, whereas animals, it doesn't describe animals that way. So what do you mean? Animals also come together. Why doesn't it say Alkein Yasuf at Habehema, at his parents, and become one? So he says that's not right. It means commitment. So he adds a little bit more to relationship. That is, animals don't have commitment. I'm not going to go into now if there are any of you here who are specialists in the animal world. Maybe there are. Elephants seem to have, relationships. But anyways, barring that, in Nachmanides' world, this wasn't the case. Animals, just have, sex, and they don't have commitment. Whereas that basar achad, one flesh, means commitment. But glaringly, there is no love. That is, Rashi may be right in a sense, in that what seems to be described here is a functional, right? You leave your parents' household, that's what you have to do, and to enter this other relationship. Of course, if you stayed at home with your father and mother while you're married, probably causes a lot of problems. Probably doesn't contribute to a lasting marriage. So the Torah knew very well human nature at that point, even in the Garden of Eden. And you attach yourself to your wife. But there's no love. There's no love. Now, in source 4, when you have davak, this word of cleaving, many of the instances of davak actually have to do with war and plunder. I'm not going to go into those. But the two instances of davak where it's paired with ahav, right? So ahav is missing. The two instances of davak that's paired with ahav in the Bible are both in contexts of rape. Of rape. So the first one, many of you, I think, know, is Shechem, who sees Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. I think the Bible has a lot of fun with names. Shechem, the son of an ass. I think this is clearly the case in many, many narratives. But this son sees, rapes her. Clearly, actually, the Bible is pretty clear about that. It's Inui is, I think it's pretty clear that he rapes her. The Midrashic interpretations have a little bit, aren't great for feminism. But I think he rapes her. I think there's no question about it. And then it's Vatidbak Nafsho Bedina Bat Yaakov Vayehav, which is the reverse of the way I think most rapists, what happens is more like the second case. So there you have Ahav and Davak, right? Which is not a good situation. Whatever way you want to interpret it, whether it's a rape or not, it's not a good situation. And of course, even if that's a good situation, if it leads to some kind of love, of course, the end of the story, it leads to genocide pretty well. Right, where a couple of Jacob's sons go on a rampage for revenge because honor killings, really these are honor killings. This is maybe one of the first real stories about honor killings. thank God Judaism has gotten past that, maybe because of this story. Maybe because of this story, because the Bible does not portray it in a good light. Certainly, the father doesn't see it in a good light, and they wipe out the whole town. They wipe out the whole town. So Ahav and Davak, in that case, does not lead to good things. The second instance, which is more, I think, akin to the way we conceive of, or the way we've interpreted, or the way social theorists and feminist theory actually sees rape, is very much in the story of Amnon and Tamar. So maybe less people know about that story. And this is the second time that Davak and Ahav appear together. And that is a story where Amnon, who is a son of David, rapes his sister, his half-sister. Okay, he's not a daughter from the same marriage, but a half-sister. The way it describes it is that he loves her. He loves her in unbelievable love. And then he does the deed. He rapes her. We're told, I'm talking about the wrong cleaving. Let me go to the second instance of cleaving. But in any event, that story about Amnon and Tamar is also a story where you have love. The reason I mention it is because I don't want to leave with a wrong impression of rape. That is, after he rapes Tamar, his emotions turn to hatred. He hates Tamar. Now, this is very in line with modern feminist theories of rape, is that rape is not really a sexual crime. It's a crime of, it's an aggression that's committed through sex, but it's a crime of power. That is, the person who's committing the rape asserts his power, right? His mastery over the victim. And then once the deed is done, he projects the feeling of shame about what he's done onto his victim. So it's not about love, right? But anyways, that's another story about love that ends in disaster. But the second instance in Source 4 that has cleaving and Ahav together is also not a good context. And that's, you raise the stakes here, where Shlomo married, we all know, married many, many wives. And many of those wives were foreigners, right? Va'amel Shlomo Ahav, Ahav. Nashim Nachriot Rabot Ved Bat Paro Mo'oviot Amoniot, right? Every single foreign, you know, a woman that you can imagine, he took into his household, right? Precisely from those nations that God said, don't, right? Don't do this. Bahem Davak Shlomo Li'ava, right? Again, the only other time in human relationships that you have Davak and Ava, again, clearly, right? Actually, you raise the stakes here. This is not good for, not just for the person, but this is not good for the nation, right? Now, it's interesting that, again, when you talk about power, I think many of you may know what the purpose of marriages were in monarchic times. That is, you didn't marry, right? Because you fell in love with somebody. You married to form alliances, right? You married to form alliances. And Shlomo is doing something that other kings do that is in direct contravention of the three laws. Actually, Shlomo is the embodiment of the anti-king, the king that's described in Deuteronomy, and the laws that the king has to follow, which is not to have a large army, that is many horses, not to go back, so that you won't go back to Egypt, not to have many wives, right? Not to have lots of gold and silver. These are precisely the things that signify Solomon's rule, right? He contravenes, he is the anti-king, despite all his wisdom, right? And Chazal have a few things to say about that. But what struck me is that Davak, and the missing case of Ava, right, means we look at other places in Tanakh to see where is Davak in Ava, and we find the reason why Ava is left out of the garden. Because love leads to disaster, leads to catastrophe. At least this is the biblical view. Again, don't get me wrong. I'm not telling you this is my view. I never tell people what my view is, because I'm in the scholarly world, so nobody cares what my view is. But I think this is the view of the Bible when you take all these things together. Now, I'm not going to have that much time to go into all the sources, but I want to talk about the first time love appears in the Bible. So we talked about the first time love appears between a man and a wife, the typical love that we tend to identify it with. But the very first time that love, and I think the first time it appears in the Masoretic versions, if I were to talk as a scholar, in the final edited versions of the Torah, right? It is parental love, right? And it is in the context of God telling the person who loves his child to slaughter his child. Interesting context where the first time love appears. So maybe many people know in the Akedah, this is source 6, Vayomer, God says, Kachna et bincha, your child, et yechidcha, your unique one, not your only one. It's clearly not your only one, right? Because he has another child, but the one that's somehow distinct, who you love, Isaac. And go and sacrifice him. And go and sacrifice him. Now, the way I read the Akedah, not simply, it's kind of in line. I mean, clearly the Pshat is, it's a test of Avram's commitment to God. But in line with the theory that I have about love, it is a graphic story about how when you get to the point where you love another human being, God tells you, slaughter it. God tells you, get rid of it. And the point is, I don't want you anymore to continue this relationship because it may lead to bad things. So the reason I say that is you start with, take the one you love. And if you look at Avram's past, right, we pretty well ruled out all other relationships as one that is consuming, the way love maybe consumes a relationship. We've ruled out parental because God already told him. The first test, in a sense, that Chazal see it as, is get out from your parents' house, and he leaves. So clearly, he's already passed that test where he's given up parental love. We're not told that he loves Terach, but, you know, that's ruled out. So there's no parental love to worry about, or, you know, child for a parent love. Wife, and this is in source 6b, wife, Sarah, you know what, I don't know, you could read that story. I'm not so sure they had a love relationship. Certainly the Torah never mentions it. But one story to me clearly shows that this is not an all-consuming love where you're willing to literally eradicate yourself, because we have a story explicitly where he says, you know, he enters this foreign land and he's afraid that, you know, he's going to be killed because his wife is beautiful. And he says, Imri na chotiyat, leman yitav. This is very, very, you know, people I think often miss this, maybe not. Leman yitav li ba'avurech. So that it should go well with me. I'm willing to let you go, right? So that it goes well with me. So we've ruled out Sarah. We've ruled out Sarah. We've ruled out parents. What about another wife? He had another wife, Hagar, and another son, Ishmael. I think we can safely rule them out because he's already shown that he can abandon them as well. In fact, he already went through another kind of Akedah that just before the chapter on the Akedah, where his wife tells him, throw them out. And make no mistake, it's sending them out to die. It's sending them out to die. Because he sends them out into the desert, right? Knowing that the water will run out, right? Unless they, you know, somehow hit Toronto or something and, you know, like, they're going to die. They're going to die. So he's virtually eliminated all relationships that can possibly raise that. And God now focuses on the relationship that remains. And that's a relationship that is apparently permanent because of Ava. And the reason I say that he's vanquishing Ava is because at the end of the Akedah, when the angel comes out and says, you don't have to do this, you don't have to do it, It says the following. So I'm not sure I have it here. Maybe I have it here. So at the end of the Akedah, source 6C. So when he says don't do this, it doesn't describe the child. It describes it as bincha, describes the child Isaac as yichidcha. That's it. No more ava. So the story starts off with et bincha et yichidcha asher ahavta, and when Abraham is about to do the deed, he needs no longer to go actually through with it because the mission has been accomplished, right? The ava drops off. The ava drops off. So that's what led me to this interpretation of the story, that's what's the problem. That's what's the problem. And the problem has been solved, right? So that's my interpretation of the Akedah that goes along with this theory that love between human beings maybe is not a great thing. So let me move on. I'm not sure how much longer. Oh, okay. All right. So let me take another narrative that I think really highlights this idea that I'm trying to convey more than any other narrative. Because perhaps more than any other narrative, and this is source 7, I think on the other side of your page, is the David story. If you look at the David story, there's more loves in that story that transpire than any other story. Everybody loves David. Of course, we're never told that David loves anybody else, which is interesting. By the way, very, very, very prominent biblical scholar, a guy named Moran in the 60s, wrote a seminal article that has become kind of articles that become seminal in the field on the notion of Ava in Deuteronomy. That is the Deuteronomistic notion of love, not, you know, because biblical scholars don't look at, the entire Torah as one kind of holistic text. But he had a very interesting interpretation, and that is the word Ahav in those sources in Deuteronomy doesn't mean what we identify with love. It means it's the same thing that you have in what he calls suzerain vassal treaties. That is treaties that are, we see this often, treaties that are formulated between subjects and their king demand love. So it's not love that I don't love the king because I love him. It's the kind of love maybe that somebody would show for Putin, right? That is, it's an allegiance. It's a political allegiance. That's what he showed. Now, my opinion is I think, you know, Ahav has clearly, the way I'm talking is that it has a much larger range than that in the entire Torah, and that's what I'm talking about. But I think in the David story there are tinges of this, and if David loves anybody else, if he does. I don't know. We don't know. I would say it's in that sense, in a strategic sense. David is the strategist par excellence. I would say, if anybody typifies a Machiavellian kind of way of running things, it's David. So let's look at the various people that love David, and let's see what happens to them, right? So we're told Saul, this is 7 little I, Vayavo David el Shaul, Vayamod Lefana, Vayeaveu Meod. So Saul loves, right, David. Vayilo Nose Kalim, and he was his, maybe bad move on Saul's part, he was his arms bearer. He wasn't just his musician that soothed him when this manic depression, clearly he was subject to some kind of mood disorder. Saul called a Ruach Ra. He made him do really crazy things, and David played the music, right? And it soothed him, but he was also his arms bearer. But Saul loved him very much. Next, the population. Everybody, Kol Yisrael, the Yudah, all of Israel and Judah, meaning the entire nation, not just part of the nation, right? Ahavet David, ki hu yotzei uva lefnehem. Love David because Yotzei Vava is precisely the reason you pick a king, right? Which is interesting in the story because Saul wasn't doing that. And that's the whole reason they asked for a king. They asked for a king that Latzeit Vilavo. Latzeit Vilavo, to go out and come in, doesn't mean to go out of his chamber, make an appearance, and go back in. It means to lead them into war. That's what the Israelites felt was missing. We don't have a power center that can galvanize us for either defense or imperial aspirations, right? And so David precisely fills that role, right, starting with Goliath, and everybody loves him. Michal, Saul's daughter. Vatehav Michal bat Shaul et David. By the way, Michal, Saul's daughter, who he marries, loves David. This is the only time in the entire Hebrew Bible, you can make of it what you will, that's not my lecture here, that you have a description of a woman loving a man, which is interesting. The only time. Jonathan, the crown prince, so to speak, right? The one who is destined to take over, the son of Saul, is even more. V'nefesh Yonatan nikshura b'nefesh David, was bound up with the soul of David so much. Vayehaveu Yonatan kinnafsho, loved him as much as he loved his own self, his own identity. By the way, that phrase also only occurs one other time. Some of you may know, but when it describes Jacob's relationship to Benjamin, right? So when Judah is arguing with Yosef, he doesn't yet know it's Yosef, that we can't bring this son down, or we can't like leave him, you know, and not come back with him, right? Because his soul, his identity is tied up with him. And if he's gone, then he will die. There's an ambiguity here of who's going to die. They're both going to die. They're unified. That's the description here of Yonatan and David. Now let's look at what happens to all these guys, right? So if you look at source 7, go down A. Saul already portends what's going to happen to himself at the Goliath story at the battlefield. When David, this little squirt, who's not such a little squirt, he knows exactly what he's doing. It's another lecture. This thing with the slingshot is an interesting. Everybody thinks this is a miraculous thing. It could mean that David is a much better strategist, much better at deciphering what's going on the battlefield than everybody else, how to defeat this guy Goliath. But let's leave that aside for a moment. When he's about to go into battle, look what Saul does. Vayalbesh Shaul et David madav v'natan kova. He clothes David with his armor, his helmet. Now, from a notional point of view, what is Shaul doing? He's actually coronating David. He's not doing that explicitly, but it already tells us what's going to happen. Saul subconsciously is already crowning David. But it shows something, and I want to combine all these things to show what is the danger of love that the Bible is kind of afraid of. Jonathan, same thing. Vayitpashet Yonatan et ha-me'il asher alav. Jonathan takes off his own clothing, gives it to David, madav, from his sword to his bow, everything. Again, the crown prince, the one who would ensure Saul's line, also, from a literary point of view, is actually giving up that line, giving himself up. Michal, let's skip to source 7D. Michal saves David from her father's kind of attempt to kill him, sacrifices herself, clearly alienates herself from the royal household, and not only alienates herself from the royal household, but becomes usurped. David takes another wife, and when he finally comes back to Michal, discards her like so much garbage, right? In fact, in a very humiliating way, to the point where we're told, and this is source 70, Ula Michal bat Shaul lo haya la yeled ad yom mota, that did not have children. And another way of saying never had sex with David, that is, never had a proper relationship with David. Now, if you take all these things together, I'm not even going to talk about the population. That's another lecture altogether, and that has to do with the David and Bathsheba story, but where he puts his own population in danger. He undermines the office of the king and the security of the state. But But what happens to them? So source C, at the battlefield, at the end of the first book of Samuel, Shaul dies, his three sons die, his armor bearer, all his men, right? So all of Israel.
For Michal, I thought it was because she was mocking him, and then God punished her.
So I'm not going to, right. So you're right. Let's just leave it at, right. First of all, there's a problem. She did have children, so there's a problem. But whatever it is, if God did punish her, it still means that her relationship with David ended, right? And the way David treats her, right? He does have words with her. So I don't think it undermines it. The basic thing, that there was no more relationship with Michal. Michal is destroyed, right? And these are all people who loved David. And so what I think the danger is, using this story to highlight it, is the danger is that you love someone so much that yourself disappears, that you sacrifice yourself so much for the other person that your identity is totally effaced, God does not want that. Now, this is maybe counterintuitive to what goes on in the world we see today, because I see probably many people asking themselves, people go into cafes and blow themselves up in the name of God, but I would say they don't really understand, right, of course, what the love of God means in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible. They maybe understand what it means in other biblical contexts, meaning in their own traditional context, but they don't know it in this context. So let's just get to the crux, and that is Shir HaShirim. I have a very, very different reading of Shir HaShirim than I had before I started thinking about this, and that I think most people, most liberal, secular, love this book. Because, you see, it's the book, it doesn't even have the name of God, curious book to be in the biblical canon, right? It shares that with Esther, but that's another story. It doesn't have the name of God. It's purely an erotic, a description of an erotic love, intensely erotic, with graphic physical descriptions of the lovers, nothing else. But there's a midrash that started to make me wonder. The midrash is like this, and this is source 8. Ki aza kamavet ava. And this is a line from Shir HaShirim. That's the title of my lecture, right? That death, love is as strong as death, right? So they say, what does this mean? Where do we see this? This is the love of Jonathan for David, as it says, what I just quoted you before, right? Now, so I started to think about this. Most people read this, what a tremendous thing. You see how fantastic love is, how wonderful Jonathan loved David, and this kind of is the paradigm of love. But we know where that ended up. We know that where that ended up, despite David's lament in the beginning of the second book of Samuel, where he says, his love for Jonathan, or Jonathan's love for him, was greater than the love of women. Politicians often, when they hate other politicians, take a look at what happens in any House of Commons or anything when that politician that they hate dies. Tributes from now till Mashiach comes, right? The guy was unbelievable, because when the guy's gone, there's no problem in kind of glorifying him. But however, is that something we're supposed to emulate? Is that a complementary? Is that kind of a paradigm, a model of love? Or is it something else? So I want to just end with the way I interpret the Song of Songs. Actually, I have come to interpret it as not the most secular book in the Bible that many people look at, but as perhaps the most religious book in the Bible, the most religious book. So there is what this quote is, that death is love is as strong as death, is taken from the very end, the last chapter of Shir HaShirim, which I have in source 9. What's important about this is the rest of the narrative is kind of, the rest of the book is a narrative about the love. They're seeking each other, they lose each other, one lover disappears. It's always this kind of thing of unrequited love. There's a love that's never quite captured. This is the only kind of third-party meditation on love, like kind of where the poet steps back and talks about love, the virtues of love. Let's leave it for now as the virtues of love. But listen to it. So I have the beginning, which is not the poem, but Simeni kachotam alibecha. Okay. Ki aza kamavet ava. Love is as strong as death. Kasha kisha'ol kina. Jealousy, and in parallelism, in biblical parallelism, biblical poetry, the second half of the verse often uses a synonym for the first half. So kina is a synonym for love. As harsh as sheol, right? Rishafeha rishbei esh. It's flashes thereof or darts thereof are darts of fire. Shalhevet Yah, the way I've translated it, some people see this is the only place where you have the name of God. Shalhevet Yah. Or its flames. Mayim rabim lo yuchlu lechabot et ava. Torrential waters can't kind of put it out. Im yitein ish kol hon beito ba'ava boz yavuzulo. If somebody were to give all his money, he would be utterly condemned. And then, the end. The end, the very last line of Shir Shirim, brach dodi, run away, my beloved, and be like a gazelle to the mountains. The way I read this is in line with everything I've said, that this is not a glorification of love, because the metaphors are so morbid. They're so morbid. If it was only one, so people often read this as, you know, love is as strong as death. That is, as death, right, is permanent, right? The strength of death, so is love. Love is a permanent thing. It's so powerful. I read it, if you read it together with, it compares love to death. It compares love to Sheol, which is an underworld where bodies hang around after death. It compares love to Rishafeha, darts. Everywhere else where you see this expression, it's in terms of ammunition that are used in wars to kill people. Not only that, it's totally in line, if you look at the biblical sense, it's totally in line with Sheol and death, because Reshef was a West Semitic deity of the underworld. Of the underworld that's identified with destroying crops. And so it becomes a word that's used for destruction generally in the Bible. Kin'ah, I don't have to go into that. You know, we don't. That's not a good thing. I can mention one important place where it comes up in the relationship of men and women, where the sota ordeal is all generated by kin'ah, right? That a ruach, the spirit of kin'ah, overcomes the husband, and the whole ordeal, which is a disfiguring ordeal, it's a terrible ordeal to put the wife through. In fact, I think the whole point is don't do this, right? The whole point is a graphic, way of the Bible saying don't do this, in a way Chazal actually interpreted it right out and tried to read it this way, right? That anybody who's overcome by this is a fool, overcome by this kind of emotion. But you know, it calls it Torah, the Torah, the law of jealousy. So my interpretation of this is that love is not good. Love is not good. It destroys. I mean, I take all these metaphors together, and it's not the way everybody reads it, which is probably a sign that I'm wrong. But it just seems to me, when you take it together with all these stories and all these narratives, right, and then look at Shir Shirim. Shir Shirim saying, you know, and this is, like I said, the only objective meditation on love. And if you look at the whole story, you know, they're never really getting together. The lover appears at the door. She kind of waits, then gets up. He disappears. She's humiliated in the streets. It's not really a great story. I mean, you know, despite what Art Scroll, right? So it's really insidious, actually. It's quite insidious what Art Scroll has done. Because it's one thing to say that you have a translation, and then you have comments. And you could say, you know what, this is what it means in the comments. But to lead people to believe that when it says breasts, it means the poles that carry the Aron. Or when it says, you know, I lie between your breasts, that it's Moshe and Aaron, right? And this is the translation, not the interpretation. Then what are you doing, right? Now, did Solomon commit an Avera? Because Solomon was writing for a Hebrew-speaking audience. He didn't write Moshe and Aaron. He wrote breasts, right? So apparently art scrolls can succeed with all those who don't know Hebrew. But for those who know Hebrew, know very well. And even Rashi, they say they're doing it according to Rashi, but even Rashi doesn't claim, right? Rashi is saying, okay, you know, this is what it actually means, but of course what Solomon wrote was breasts, right? And that's what he wrote. Then you can interpret it whatever way you want. And in fact, I may actually agree with the interpretation, considering my way of reading this. But that's not the translation. That's not the translation. And of course, what you should all know, what I always tell my students, never be misled by when somebody says a translation, right? Every translation is an interpretation, right? There's no such thing as a translation from one language into another that's not an interpretation. No such thing. The proof of the pudding is with the Bible, you have dozens of interpretations. Why would I need dozens of translations? If the translation is simply, right, it's just not that way. Anybody in literature understands that, translating from German or from any language. You're always making interpretive choices. Just to bring one example, and I want to end, right, that I always raise, Va'ish Moshe Anav Ma'od, right? Moses was, so if you take the King James translation, was the meekest man. Now, anybody who's read about Moshe cannot possibly, this cannot possibly be a description of Moshe, who the first thing we see is to kill a guy, right? He gets so enraged that he kills a guy. He kills thousands of people at the Eagle. This is not a guy who's meek, right? So it's theologically tendentious, right? It depends who's translating it. If you're a Christian, the meek shall inherit the earth, and therefore Moses, the great prophet, is the meekest man on the earth. That's just an aside. But the way I convinced myself that this was a correct way of reading this was the last verse. The last verse is she tells the lover, brach, run away. Why in the world, after this meditation on love, does the beloved tell the lover to run away? And so I looked at all the biblical scholarship. Because every biblical scholar, everybody who wants to read it as this erotic love that's consummated at the end. It's all flee with me. They all add this. Flee with me. Flee to me. Return. Come into the open. Hurry. Some even write, run away from the companions. There are these other people that are mocking and humiliating her. They can't take the last line. For me, it's obvious, right? That is, she's telling him, run away. And by the way, I looked at, you know, everywhere where it says barach, it means to run away from something, to escape something. Everywhere, right? And so in my interpretation, it is, I love you. I love you intensely, but I fear the point where I'm going to completely give up my identity and lose my own identity. And so that's why I come back to the first line, which precedes this meditation, Simani kachotam alibecha. So again, most of the readers read this as place me as a seal, meaning actually the opposite of what I'm saying. You know, bind me to yourself so that I become one with you. In fact, when you see chotam, a seal, right? For me, a seal in the Bible is a symbol of your identity. It's not merging with the other person. So when you have Yehuda and Tamar, for instance, right? Yehuda, Tamar, at the time, he thinks she's a prostitute, right? Takes his seal. The seal is a symbol of his identity, right? A symbol of his identity. We just read Esther a while ago, where Ahasuerus sends out Svarim that are chatum, the sealed with the ring of the king. That's how you know that the identity of the king hovers over this document, right? So to me, it's the opposite. What the woman is saying before they enter into this morbid discussion of Ava and its destructive characteristics, she says, please put me as a seal and maintain my identity as we're in love. Maintain the relationship that it describes in the Garden of Eden of Azer Kenegdo. Now, most people, again, feminists like to read this as a disparaging of women. Azer doesn't mean that. In fact, God, we often look at God in Tehillim as an Azer. Does that mean God is like an appendage of us? Or it means, and Sforno actually has a very, very interesting remark, Azer Kenegdo, the only time something, if we put something on scales, two things on scales, the only time that they're Kenegdo, that they're opposite each other, is when they're equally balanced, is when they're equally balanced. So she's saying, maintain my identity as a seal. The seal is a measure of my identity, and protect me. So that's my spiel about love. I'm sorry I took a little bit, maybe longer, but maybe a few minutes for questions. I don't know. Okay.